Thank you again for joining me today. I really appreciate your time. I'm really looking forward to talking with you.
Okay, well, let's see how that goes. Well, by the time we've got to the end of it.
So, of course, the recent news in the UK is that there's a mutant strain of COVID, and this has led to new, even more drastic lockdowns. How are things going over there for you, first of all?
Well, this is the thing I call the Teenage Mutant Ninja Virus. I don't think that there is a proper case has been made for any seriousness. I also think that the British government have made fools of themselves. I don't think they realized when they said this that so many overseas governments would say, oh, well, in that case, if you've got this terrifying virus abroad, we won't allow anybody from Britain to come to our country and we won't trade with you. It simply didn't occur to them that by pronouncing that we were in the grip of this terrible thing, mask of the Red Death or whatever it is, that we would actually become unattractive to others. They were doing what they've done so many times before and trying to frighten the British population. They didn't mean to frighten the United States or France or Germany, but they did. And I think they may now be regretting it, but it's too late. The trouble with fear is that once you've unleashed it, it stomps about like a monster all over the forest, and you can't control it. Mm-hmm. And they have done this, and it is from the start that we had this thing called the SAGE Committee, which back in March, it's a pinned tweet at the top of my Twitter account, actually said that the government wasn't frightening people enough. And they sure put that right. They've been frightening us like anything ever since. And this seems to be more and more fear in support of what has always been a completely disproportionate response. And it's backfired on them in quite a serious fashion. And I don't sympathize with them. I'm grieved for what now happens to the country, because the economic damage of having all kinds of countries saying, we can't trade with you, we can't allow you into our country, is huge. And also the feeling of isolation in our country, you can't go anywhere anymore, is quite strong. I've almost been suffering an almost physical claustrophobia recently because of the feeling of being hemmed in by oppression and limitations and excessive government power. And the idea that I can't travel is particularly repulsive to me, because I've spent so much of my life traveling and I love to be able to do it, particularly continental Europe. And it's virtually unthinkable there.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, so why do you think that they instilled new lockdown measures just before Christmas? I mean, it can't really be. I mean, viruses mutate. I mean, is this news?
Well, you're asking me to treat them as if they're rational, when my view has been from very early on that they're actually quite stupid. That what we have is a stupid government, which was easily panicked by people whom it believed to be expert. And it wasn't very difficult to look up the record of Imperial College, which has been the main source of most of the advice that we've had, and see that they had, over foot and mouth disease and over a number of other things, greatly exaggerated the danger. They had a reputation for this. And that the government, having been panicked by this exaggeration, but been panicked to such an extent that it more or less strangled an already pretty shaky economy and done a great deal of damage to the National Health Service, which it claims to be so interested in protecting, and had probably in the long term killed a very large number of businesses and jobs. They could not admit, these are politicians, they could not admit they made a terrible mistake. And so they have to keep on doubling down on it. And that's what they do. But fundamentally, the problem is that these people are not fit for the tasks which they perform. They are not their children. I've met them. They're not. And I have spent a lot of time in my life earlier on as a political reporter dealing with politicians. They are simply are not qualified for the responsibilities which they have. And this has never been better demonstrated than now. So there's no point trying to apply normal human wisdom or reason to examining what they do. These are frightened people in rooms too big for them, being with people constantly whispering in their ear, minister, do this, do that, do the other, and not having any way of testing in their minds whether the thing they're being urged to do is right or wrong, and given repeatedly to panic. And on this occasion, they did the same thing. Mm-hmm. We have, obviously, there is a disease. Some people die from it. A lot of people don't. It's probably comparable in size to several previous epidemics, including the great 1957 Asian flu and the 68-69 Hong Kong flu, and not all that much bigger than episodes which happen in most northern countries of serious respiratory disease right about the time of year. And we have this we have this exaggeration of the danger. We have a completely disproportionate reaction, and we have people who probably deep in their hearts know that they've been disproportionate, but they haven't the courage to admit it, and so they carry on doing it. And until some means is found of restraining them by constitutional and legal means, they'll carry on doing it.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that this situation was treated so differently than similar situations in the past?
I wish I knew. I think it is partly because we used to be a better educated country than we are now, for a start. We used to have a much more rigorously educated elite. I place a lot of the blame on the destruction of particularly of our secondary school system back in the 1960s. We had selective secondary schools, which we called grammar schools. I know in North America that means something else, but to us what it means is often very old, ancient schools which selected their students entirely on the grounds of merit and were extremely rigorous. Once you got to them, if you were thought to be qualified to go, you were given an extraordinarily rigorous education, and then you would go on to university, and universities also were very selective, particularly the ancient ones. And therefore we produced a highly educated elite which was capable, for instance, of resisting mob pressure. And since the middle 60s, when we destroyed these schools, we've had an increasingly egalitarian education in which people have been taught not how to think, but what to think, in which conformism has become much more powerful. And that's been added to, of course, by the huge conformist power of television and the even more huge conformist power of the internet, which makes everybody want much more the same than they were. And under circumstances like this, what every country needs is a group of people who are respected and in positions of authority who can say, actually, we're not sure about this. Can we hesitate for a moment while we think about it? And that, there are no breaks. That group of people has by and large been abolished. They're not there anymore. And so nobody says, I found that at the beginning of this, I think I was the only person in the British media who was saying, how on are we doing the right thing? The only one. And I thought, as one always thinks when one's on one's own, have I got this right? But I also thought, the fact that I'm on my own actually reinforces my suspicion that I am right. That in a conformist world, the person who stands out may well be right. The funny thing about all societies, ever since Hans Christian Andersen wrote his brilliant story about the Emperor's New Clothes, is people read the story or they hear it told and they think, gosh, that's clever, and how brilliant of the little boy to spot that the emperor had no clothes on. The truth is that in most modern Western societies, if the emperor had no clothes and the little boy said he had no clothes, the secret police would arrest him and his parents and drag them away. And everybody would say, good, stupid, horrible, nasty little boy, how dare he say this thing? And there is a huge and powerful conformist current in all societies, which means that the person who stands against it is usually, first of all, subjected to sliming and abuse. And only much later is anything he says taken seriously. And I've experienced this. You have put up with it. It's no fun, but it's necessary. It's alarming to see that in a major country with a long history of separation of powers and careful thought and an adversarial parliament, all these things are dead. All the things which are supposed to restrain power, all the things which are supposed to make people pause, they've all crumbled away.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I predict that the people who told the truth in the first place and were brave enough to, you know, go against the current despite being mocked and attacked and called names and dismissed, etc. I mean, once people come around and realize that they were right, in fact, that those individuals were right, I suspect that they won't admit that they were on the wrong end of the debate, and that the person they attacked was actually right, in fact.
A very interesting thing has happened, really, in the past 20 years. When it was plain that the that the governments of the West had lied about weapons of mass destruction in Iran. This fact became clearly admitted. There wasn't any question about it. And it has influenced, you would think, everybody ever since to understand that the Iraq war was fought on a false premise. And everybody remembers that. But have we learned anything from this? And the answer is, on the contrary, people have learned nothing from it. They're still willing to be talked into all kinds of rash events. Governments learned something quite different. Governments learned that if you're going to lie, then you must lie much more effectively, and you must lie much more in a much more concentrated fashion, and you must devise new devices to make that lie stick. Now, I got involved, this has nothing to do with coronavirus, but I got involved just over a year ago in a controversy about whether President Assad in Syria had used chemical weapons in a place called Duma outside Damascus. And it seemed to me, from what I could discover from reading the reports of the United Nations Agency for Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, that there wasn't actually very good evidence this had happened. And I wrote this from basing it on nothing other than the reports of the UN agency itself. And I was then approached by various persons who were whistleblowers, who were inspectors in the Chemical Weapons Agency, who said, "You're right. This thing has been misrepresented. The report has been seriously censored to give a false impression." And I have no doubt, because I've done an awful lot of research, and I have no doubt that what I had was a very powerful story on the same sort of level as the non-existence of weapons of mass destruction. And what happened was that I was attacked personally by huge numbers of people, called a war crimes denier, which I can demonstrate by long years of abuse of the Assad regime, which I despise, called an apologist for the Assad regime, and all kinds of other things. And what was quite extraordinary was the number of journalists who, rather than follow or touch or even investigate an important story, preferred to pile in on me. And I thought, this is extraordinary, and it's also very clever. The governments, having realized that they can never allow WND to happen again, have not decided they'll never again make stupid wars on false pretexts, but they will make damn sure that anyone who discovers the pretext is false, is isolated and made to look as stupid as possible, and is slandered so that what he has said is not heard. So most of the mainstream media of the Western countries involved in the attack on Syria, which followed this alleged chemical weapons incident, have never touched the story. And if they have, they've touched it in such a way as to suggest that I am more or less a Russian agent.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
which I assure you I'm not.
we've already gotten that out in the clear. I mean, I guess what's interesting in part is that, we're talking about the lockdowns in particularly, but I've seen this happen in other areas, and I'm sure you have seen it happen many times as well, which is that, you know, the public is so enthusiastic about going along with this kind of slander. So not only is there the aspect in terms of the lockdowns particularly where the public is enthusiastic about these rules and regulations and these lockdowns and the loss of their civil liberties and the loss of their freedoms, but they're also enthusiastic about attempting to destroy the credibility of anybody who questions almost any aspect, including the mask mandates and the lockdowns and, you know, testing accuracy, anything. I mean, they're on board, and I really have trouble understanding why. And actually, you know, at the beginning of all this, I supported the lockdown measures. I thought they were going to be very short term. You know, I didn't, I believed them when they said it would be a couple of weeks. And I was like, sure, let's just get this over with. And then I started to realize that it wasn't just going to be a couple of weeks. And I started to read alternative viewpoints and sources and started to question the necessity and the short and long term harms. But I'm baffled by the public support for all this.
Well, a lot of people are afraid of freedom. They're afraid of the responsibility which it places on them. And it's hard to admit this, but I think it's true. A lot of people welcome the opportunity to cast aside that responsibility. and to cast aside the freedom which compels them to have it. And fear, although it's unpleasant to be afraid, it's not so unpleasant to be afraid in a large mass of people, and to hand over, as you fall into that fear, to hand over your responsibilities to deal with the monster which you've been told is stamping around in the forest just outside the stockade. Somebody else will take that from you. And I think that it is important to understand that freedom is not necessarily what everybody wants, that quite a lot of people don't like. It's just in the same sort of way, if you have an argument about freedom of speech, an awful lot of people know they're supposed to be in favor of freedom of speech, but at some point in any discussion of it, they will say, but actually, I don't think that such and such a person should be free to say such and such a thing. Most people actually don't really like freedom of speech either, and they don't like individual freedom to make choices. They really want to be. I don't think any of us who hasn't at some stage felt this desire to be rid of responsibility. There are very few people who seek responsibility. I certainly myself have had moments when I've been glad to be shot of it. If I've been a deputy in some job or other that I wasn't particularly good at, and my boss went away for a few weeks, I was always glad when he came back. And I think that I have to be honest about that. And I think this is a characteristic in many people. There's another analogy I give. If I ride a bicycle in London, I say I'm riding to catch a train. And I know that it's a very close-run thing. And if I really pedal hard, and I can catch the train I want to catch. But I know that I'll get to the station, I'll have to lock my bike, I'll drop the lock, I'll make a mess of it, I'll pick it up, I'll lock it, I'll run to the train, and in a muck sweat, I'll climb aboard at the last minute. Or at some point, there'll be some traffic incident, or the police will close the road, and I will know then that I'm not going to catch that train. I'll have to catch a later one, and the whole problem disappears. And I there's a kind of relief in it. So people are often relieved to have responsibility taken from them. The really peculiar thing, you call the mask mandate, and I call the muzzle decree, is how many people actually, I think, quite like wearing those things. How many people like being submissive? There's something. As Sigmund Freud said, a cigar is not just a cigar, but I would reply to that, a mask is never just a mask. I think there's something frighteningly submissive about the way in which people give into this. And there are certain types of persons, I refer to them as the muzzle strutters, who almost have a pride and joy in walking around the streets looking like that. And they're wearing, as they do it, a badge saying, I submit to the government, I believe the government is right. Well, I have to say, everything in my upbringing and nature tells me that I'm never going to do that anyway. My principal journalistic slogan and watchword is never believe anything until it's been officially denied, my view of journalism is that the proper relation between journalism and power is the relation between a dog and a lamppost. And I'm shocked to find other people being submissive, but I know that they are. Mm-hmm. And it's they are, and it's fascinating they are. The other thing I say is, you're looking at the way in which people have behaved during this, if you've had any doubt at any point in your life how you would have behaved during any of the great periods of oppression in the past century, now you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I mean I'm sort of like you, and I have trouble relating to, you know, my automatic reaction or my automatic instinct to being told to wear a mask is to rebel, like, you know, almost in a childish way, like, don't tell me what to do. But also, to me,
is it childish to rebel against imposed authority and people telling you what to do without providing a rational justification for it? Because they don't. And one of the fascinating things about this is you get involved in it, which I've become far too involved in it. I'm really boring on the subject because I know too much about it. They have never provided a rational justification for it. Mm-hmm. And the more that people look into it, the more it becomes clear it's a complete waste of time. But even to say that, I mean, I don't know what platform you put these things out. Even to say that will probably get you banned by Facebook.
Well, and I mean, people will
maybe banned by Facebook or by YouTube, I should say.
Yeah. Well, I read recently that a video that you did, an interview that you did, was banned from YouTube, and then I think they reinstated the video. But I mean, I was shocked because I watched the interview and it wasn't particularly controversial.
Yeah, this is what I did with Peter Whittle. They took it down and then they were embarrassed into putting it up again. But they froze the counter, so we don't actually know in the end how many people watched it.
Right.
I got shadow banned some months ago. Pretty certain. With the problem with shadow banning is you can't prove it's happened, but certainly the trigonometry people who ran the interview and had done one with me before on a completely different site were astonished at how few views it was getting, and they were certain that some sort of dirty work had gone on at the crossroads. There's an awful lot of this about on the mask thing as well. This is where it is interesting rather than boring. There used to be a lot of material on the net very skeptical about masks, including a very interesting survey done for the dental industry before all this became a controversy about how effective they were in dentistry. And it just disappears. You can't find it on the internet anymore. And I find that really creepy. It's 1984-ish. It's the memory hole. It's he who controls the future, he who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past, because he can wipe out from human knowledge things which really happen and stuff which was published, which is skeptical about masks, is very, very hard to find now. Much harder to find than it was 6 months ago.
And of course, people who are, I was at the swimming pool the other day, and there was literally a woman in the pool wearing a mask. I see, couples walking around outside wearing masks. I don't know if they think they're going to infect one another. But
yeah, it's a badge of morality, because what people have been told, this is a very clever propaganda method. They've been told that by wearing a mask, they're not protecting themselves. Oh, no. They're protecting other people. It's a selfless action. So the wearing of it is a declaration of goodness. And who would not want to do that? And I have to say, many women actually look quite good in masks, especially the fancy ones they get. So
I find it embarrassing.
The concentration on the eyes is actually quite striking. Okay. And I think women are aware of it. So who can blame them for taking advantage of this? That here they are, they can look good, and they can look moral as well.
I mean,
most men look stupid all the time. Anyway, they don't look any better with it.
I personally feel stupid. I hate wearing a mask, first of all, because I can't breathe, and I feel angry and by the people who insist that it's fine. Why are you complaining? What's the big deal? It's just a piece of fabric over your face.
It's just a piece of cloth. Nothing to worry about.
And
all these things are the surrender to power and authority is. And of course, Godwin's law says one mustn't make comparisons, but it was a little thing that people had to start saying Heil Hitler instead of Guten Tag. It was a little thing, but they had to do it. And once they'd done it, they'd given away a piece of their souls. And because the comparison exists, it's shocking, and I'm probably doing myself no end of harm by even raising it. But if you look for examples of previously free advanced societies voluntarily surrendering their freedom, then you'll find things like that.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think that so many people believe that masks are effective? What evidence are they, coming across that has convinced them that masks will protect other people if they're infected, for example?
Well, partly there's a great change in what people think science is. And when I was being educated, what science was the Karl Popper concept, was that science was a hard thing, where the value of a proposition had really to be tested by experiment and falsifiability, and it was objective knowledge. But in recent years, increasingly in large areas of argument, science has become much more subjective. So there are these meta-analyses, and there are which are full of words like could or may or might, and an awful lot of subjective opinion has crept into it. And a lot of people can't tell this from what I refer to as hard science, or indeed don't think that the distinction applies anymore. I've been told off for referring to Karl Popper's rules of what makes a scientific proposition, and told that I'm out of date and not in fashion. Well, I know that I'm out of date and not in fashion, but it still seems to me that what science is, what the scientific method has always been, is a total devotion to objective truth and a willingness to abandon anything which is demolished by experiment. And this seems to have more or less vanished from discourse. The hard knowledge which we have of the effectiveness of face masks is very small. And the most important experiment done on the subjects was done in Denmark in earlier on this year. And it was done by people who were in favor of masks. And yet it came up with a result in which the difference between the number of people testing positive for COVID and the number of people not testing positive for COVID among two controlled groups, enormous controlled groups, who either worn masks or not worn masks for several weeks, was so small it was not statistically significant. Those are the words in the report. And therefore, the whole idea that masks protect the wearer has been pretty much destroyed by the only major experiment done on the subject. There's been no experiment on whether masks protect other people. But it would seem to me that unless the virus only flies one way, and unless a cloth mask only operates in one direction, if it doesn't protect the wearer, it's pretty unlikely it's going to protect anybody else. But that's just me. Mm-hmm. But that's what we have. But this report was first of all, it couldn't get published in any major scientific journal. Three major journals rejected it. A fourth one did, and the leader of the study has since said that they suggested a certain, how should I put it, refinements. It seems to me there are a lot of things in the final published report which are very heavy caveats saying this should not be taken to mean this, that, and the other, and so, which have been put in to make it easier for the journal to publish, because if it had been published in its raw form, I suspect it would have been even more disturbing to the consensus. But whatever happens, if even to mention it is difficult, and to get it covered in major mainstream newspapers or broadcasting is almost impossible because it came up with the wrong answer, even though, as I say, the main leading scientist in the world very much wanted it to come up with evidence that must reflect it. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. But you haven't heard of it.
No, I hadn't realized.
This is the thing. I find in so many of the arguments that I have about this, and it's once you get involved in this debate, you're constantly in receipt of information, studies and things which other people are perhaps not seeing, and you learn of the existence of scientists who are saying things other than the mainstream. But there are huge numbers of people who aren't even aware that there is a debate. They've never heard of the Great Barrington Declaration. They don't know there are any dissenting scientists. They think there's only one opinion. They simply don't know, because it's a shocking behavior of so many people in my trade of journalism who simply are not doing their job.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, and you can tell in the way that people respond to any kind of pushback or questioning, which is that they'll say, listen to the science. So they've taken that mantra that I think that they've taken that from the climate change debate. Listen to the science, listen to the science. They don't provide you with any science, of course. They just say, listen to the science. But they think that the rules that they're following in these, you know, they think that their beliefs are science.
Well, this is a large part of the problem. And this is what has gone wrong with science and the public understanding of science. In our country, Professor Ferguson of Imperial College has been a leading advisor of the government and is the main epidemiologist they seem to turn to, and the one the BBC interviewed more than anyone else. But there are other epidemiologists, notably a very distinguished professor in my home city of Oxford, Sunetra Gupta, who differs from him, but she is not interviewed by the BBC and not listened to by the government. But people aren't aware of the fact that there is this dissent.
Yeah. So early on, when these restrictions first began, when these lockdowns first began, did you predict that they would go on for so long?
I had no idea. I had an instinctive feeling that something wrong was going on, but I could no, I could not, I don't pretend for a moment that I ever imagined that it'd be sustained for this long. And I've been shocked by that. Now I understand what's going on, and my feeling is that it may well go on forever now, unless enough public opinion is marshaled, unless enough parliamentary opinion and legal opinion is marshaled to say this must stop, we've made a mistake. Because even if this particular virus or its mutant ninja variations go away, how long before another one appears? That is again a pretext for the most severe shutting down of society that we've ever seen, for more mass house arrest, for more strangling of the economy. If we accept this logic, we accept the logic that's behind this, then we've condemned ourselves forever to these measures. It won't go away. And I didn't see it at the beginning, but I'm afraid I see it now.
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to predict where the end, where this will all go, because how does this end? I mean, as you say, there's always going to be mutations. I don't see how, I think a lot of people believe that the vaccine will come and then everything will change and we'll go back to normal. And I don't see how that could possibly happen.
I mean, I'd love it if it did, but I don't get that feeling. Apart from anything else, governments have become used to having much more power over people, and a lot of people have become used to having much less independent lives and don't seem to find it disturbing. I think the real problem in my country is that the economic strain of this is going to tell. That huge numbers of people have been on what we call furlough, which is basically paid by the government for doing nothing. A system which has now been extended to April, so it will have been going on for a whole year. This cannot be sustained indefinitely, and nor can the levels of government borrowing be sustained indefinitely. So several things have to happen. There has to be a very large increase in taxation. A lot of people will lose jobs, which they've only really got nominally now. The state of our currency has got to be affected by these levels of debt, and so all the major economic pressures on the individual will greatly increase. People will become suddenly poorer and a lot less secure. And at that point, I think there could be very serious political trouble in sustaining this. People say, well, we didn't realize, we simply didn't know this is what you meant. Because most people are not really particularly interested in economics, and they have a very slight grasp on it. And they genuinely think if the government says, well, this is money, it will always be worth something. But as in the old Rudyard Kipling poem, the gods of the copybook headings, we could end up having plenty of money, but nothing that money can buy. And I do greatly fear that, because the problem with that kind of circumstance is that it may lead to something I really dread, which is major civil disorder. And the outcome of major civil disorder is all too frequently an even stronger state than the one we have already.
Do you think that there should have been any restrictions at all?
I don't know. I think the idea that you quarantine the healthy is a huge break with the past, and I'm not even sure it's sensible. And I'm an anti-utopian. I'm in favor of ameliorating things. I fundamentally, although I'm categorized in my own country as a wild, foaming at the mouth, knuckles brushing the ground right winger, I'm actually more or less in economic matters a social democrat. So I believe in making things better within reason, but I don't think there's a perfect society available. I think there is a huge level of utopianism in what the government is doing. It's moved on from the original flattening the curve and reducing the pressure on the hospitals. To an attempt apparently to abolish the disease entirely, which I've compared to the government trying to stop autumn happening by sending the army out to go and glue all the leaves back on the trees. It's a complete overestimate of the power of what government can do. And I don't think it can work. There are all kinds of things we could have done. I mean, it's plain that it went wrong in the care homes. This is also true, by the way, in that very interesting country, Sweden. they messed up their care homes very badly too. And it's also quite plain that a lot of this is a problem not confined to, but very heavily falling upon old people. Mm-hmm. The health of old people in many Western countries, although their lives have been prolonged by successful use of drugs such as statins, things like this, is vulnerable, particularly in wintertime, to respiratory disease. And I think particularly was the case in Italy, that the reason why so many people died was precisely because the Italians had been so fantastically, creditably successful in prolonging the lives of their population. And so they had a greatly large number of people who were vulnerable to a disease of this kind when it came. What can you do about that? You can't stop death entirely. And you must be careful that the measures that you take don't damage people. Again, in Britain, it's increasingly clear with the nature of our health service that quite large numbers of people missed out on important treatments for cancer, heart disease, and strokes, which have almost certainly led to people dying or becoming seriously ill who, had it not been for the government's overreaction, would have been operated upon, had their cancers or their heart problems detected in time, and would now be healthy, leaving aside the catastrophic effects on mental health of so many previously healthy old people, particularly, being forced into a compulsory solitude, which is terribly bad for young people and also very even worse for the old. So I'm prepared to consider anything, but my fundamental rule on any measure is proportion. If you're at war with a mad tyrant who proposes to enslave your population and drag them off to death camps, then there's almost nothing that you shouldn't do to fight them. You can tax people to the last penny you can get out of them. You can militarize society. You can suspend all kinds of freedoms because you're in a life and death struggle for everything you value. But that isn't what we're involved in here. We are dealing with a major but not gigantic outbreak of respiratory disease, which is simply doesn't justify the level of the measures taken. So I can't say. Here's my answer to that question in general. If you see a man, you're walking down the street, and one of your neighbors comes out in the street, and his face is full of woe, and he says, "Look, I've got a wasp nest in my house. So to deal with it, I'm going to burn my house down." Your first duty is to take him to one side and say, "Look, sorry, Jim, but this is not a sensible way of dealing with the wasps." After you persuade him not to burn his house down, you can say, "Well, you know, call the local authority and get them to send the man who deals with wasp nests." But the main thing you have to do is to stop him doing the mad thing. So I haven't really given much thought to what I would do because, first of all, I'm powerless. And secondly, my main task is to try and stop them doing something mad.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about the concern about hospitals being overwhelmed? Because in Canada, at least, I think that people, I live in BC, and we haven't had a lot of deaths here. They keep doing these like case tallies daily, which sound like a lot, but of course, cases don't really mean much of anything necessarily, or positive case results. So test results, I'm sorry. But the concern is that if we loosen the restrictions, the hospitals will become overwhelmed, which of course was the justification for the lockdowns in the first place. So do you think that there is a genuine concern that without these restrictions, the hospitals will become overwhelmed and that will, you know, hurt people, hurt the healthcare workers, hurt the system, et cetera?
We have an excellent think tank in our country which looks into the facts and statistics of our own National Health Service, which we fondly imagine to be the envy of the world, but I've never come across anyone who envies it. But what it has done over the past 20 years is greatly reduced the number of beds available. And it's among the beds which have diminished, of course, intensive care beds. So almost not every year, but many years during the winter, If you read our newspapers and watch our televisions, particularly the local stations, you'll see accounts of hospitals being severely under pressure from generally in the winter, what is it called, the winter crisis, usually involving influenza and pneumonia, old people with respiratory disease. It's a known problem. It happens all the time. It's not unique. We have this again this year. There's no doubt about it. Sometimes the hospitals come under considerable strain. Well, during the spring, our government built these huge new, fantastic achievement, mainly, I think, done by the army, these huge new hospitals called the Nightingale Hospitals, named after Florence Nightingale, to deal with this. And they were hardly used, even at the very peak in March and April of deaths from the virus. And they proved not to be necessary. And since then, Fraser Nelson, the editor of the Spectator magazine, has written a very interesting blog post on what actually happened, because he managed to obtain rather cleverly the statistics on intensive care, which are not generally available in real time. And there was never at any stage, even at the height of the COVID outbreak in the spring, there was never any real pressure on our hospitals. So I'm no doubt that in some places where the provision is poor and where there might be a for some reason, a higher incidence of the disease, there will be excessive strains on hospitals, people unable to get into the hospital, kept in the ambulances outside, people put on trolleys and corridors. These are terrible things, which I would rather didn't happen. But it's not new that they happen, and they have happened before, and they will happen again, and they're not necessarily connected with COVID. And there's another fascinating thing, which is apparently, according to statistics, the two diseases which normally cause most trouble in this time of year, namely, as I mentioned earlier, pneumonia and influenza, have virtually disappeared. Everybody who's in hospital for a respiratory disease apparently has COVID. Mm. Again, leads one to the other thing. How accurate and how unmisleading have the statistics been which the government has given us on what's been going on here? Have people been classified as dying with or suffering with COVID? Also had other diseases which may have been just as important or more important in their outcomes. And I just feel these things really do need to be examined. I personally would favor a very serious inquiry into this after it's over, though the terrible danger of it is, given the political pressure, it'll come up with the standard slogan of the lockdown zealots, which is that it would all be much better if we'd locked down earlier. But I think somehow or other we need to fight that to avoid a repetition of it. But there are so many things about this where exaggeration, a statistical sleight of hand, has given an impression that things are different from the way they actually are, that I just tend to be a little skeptical about everything I've told them, since I've double-checked it with an independent expert, and I would advise anybody to take that.
Mm-hmm. And so what should we have done differently in terms of the care homes? I mean, I think this is probably common to most countries, but certainly in Canada, the biggest problem with deaths has been in the care homes.
I'm sorry, I don't know, because what I would dearly love to see would be a report on what actually happened and how the disease spread so fast. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. I would just say I think plainly something did go wrong. There can't be any question that the numbers of deaths were far greater than they should have been. But I'm not going to try to apportion blame or responsibility until I've seen a proper independent inquiry into that. But I just say plainly it went wrong. Mm-hmm. Nobody argues about that. But how and why it happened, I need to know more. And also, I say, did equally well go wrong in Sweden, where the care homes are much bigger than they are in Britain, and where when it went wrong, it went really wrong.
Mm. So what countries do you think handled this in an effective way from your perspective?
I'm very interested in what happened in Japan, but it's not so much a handling in an effective way. I think that there are many. I'm a great admirer of Japan. It's one of the most fascinating, understudied countries in the world. But what they didn't have was a large number of deaths among the old. And the other thing they didn't have, because their constitution forbids it, is the kind of restrictions on personal liberty which have been introduced in many supposedly free Western nations. They've pretty much restarted their economy. They are pretty much living normally. They had, I'd say, very, very low deaths among the old. And we have to ask here, in that case, what is it about Japan, their care of the old, which might have made a difference, and that would be interesting. I don't think it had much to do, I don't think it ever has much to do with the nature or extent of the shutdowns which countries have actually imposed. The fascinating thing is, if you look at lots and lots of countries and different states in the USA, you'll find nowhere any reliable congruence between the severity of shutdown and the number of deaths. There's no relation between them at all. And there's no pattern. I've tried to find this isn't one. And it's not there. So the whole presumption, and it's a presumption more than an assumption of the people in favor of shutdowns, that shutdowns actually axiomatically save lives, doesn't seem to me to have been proven. And the Japanese experience, where the number of deaths among the old didn't happen, raises the question, what is it about the Japanese way of life? What is it about? Because it's a very heavily urbanized, very crowded country with enormously dense cities and quite a lot of old people. Why is it they didn't suffer as we did? I think that'll be a question worth asking.
I wonder, in North America at least, this issue has become polarized in terms of left versus right. So the left wingers are very, very much in favor of all of the lockdowns, of mask wearing, of mask mandates. They're opposed to questioning of any of this. And it has become essentially another means of virtue signaling your political, which end of the political spectrum you're on, in at least the left does. So the left's investment in writing off anybody who is right wing or far right or whatever label they want to use, they've done that with COVID. Has that happened in the UK?
I think so. But it's a curious thing. I mean, during my extremely left wing youth in the 1960s and early 1970s, I suspect that had any government tried to behave as ours is behaving now, it would have been the left which would have opposed it. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, my own theory is that the Western world has undergone a huge cultural, moral, and social revolution in that period, which has more or less enthroned the left in power, but not in the sort of power that the old revolutionaries used to dream of. You don't have to seize the post office and the barracks and the railway station anymore. What they've seized is the television studio and the newspaper office and the university and the school. And they are so much in power that I think they nowadays see themselves as the defenders of power. And they, I think it's in the nature of the left and its utopian desires that it obviously sees the disadvantages in a strong state, but it can also see the advantages in it. If you want to embark on a huge egalitarian project of changing the way in which people live and ultimately changing human nature, which in my view is the left's most fundamental desire, then a strong state appeals to you. And this is plainly on the grounds of never let a good crisis go to waste. This is plainly a very good opportunity to strengthen the state, which is being very thoroughly taken, and most left-wing people these days would put that before their old-fashioned concern for liberty. And it does make me make sort of the cynical reflection that maybe the left were only in favor of liberty and against too much concentrated power because they didn't have that power, and now they've got it. They're not the friends of liberty anymore, and I think that's one of the transformations we're going to have to get used to. I have to tell you that an awful lot of right-wing, supposedly, people have been pretty useless in this matter as well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've wondered about this also lately because I've always been on the left and sort of, I've made a shift within the past few years, at least in terms...
Nobody who hasn't been there really understands anything. It's also sometimes a good place to leave.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I suppose what I've started to wonder lately is, you know, is there like a fundamental problem with the left, with the ideologies that the left embraces? There's obviously been a shift where the left stopped supporting freedom of speech and civil liberties and sort of became the opposers of freedom rather than the defenders of freedom. Yeah. But it made me wonder if there was something fundamentally wrong that I just didn't see before.
In my view, it's all about utopianism. And the whole direction of the world altered, really, in the years immediately before and during the French Revolution, when people who believed that human nature could be changed and the world could be changed and we could begin the world over again became, for the first time, seriously influential in politics and thought. And that's never gone away. And this belief in perfectibility, this belief in some sort of utopia, this belief in the almost unlimited power of the state, which leads, for instance, to the delusion that the state can defeat a virus, is first of all very appealing, because who can not yearn for the world to be better than it is? There has to be something wrong with it if you thought that it was okay. And also, you yourself, then, if you're engaged in this great high purpose, you can justify anything that you do, because you say, look, what I'm doing is so good that I can employ any means to do it. That has always been the greatest problem of the left, and it's why it's so very often that the left's disagreements, I mean, what serious intelligent person minds being disagreed with or thinks that the people who oppose him are wicked? But this is very much the view of so much of the left, that not merely the people like me are wrong, but that we're bad. And once you have that idea in your head, and once you have between your teeth the view that you're saving the world from a terrible disease, there's nothing you can't do. And here we are, and it's happening.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and the other aspect of this that baffles me is that, you know, so I'm somebody who's, I've changed my mind about a number of things in recent years, but I also, you know, I changed my mind about COVID and the response to COVID. I've changed my mind about the left. I've changed my mind about freedom of speech. And I quite enjoy changing my mind about things. I find it like kind of thrilling.
I find it very difficult and quite painful.
Oh, I mean, I enjoy it because I feel like, I mean, because it's part of learning. You learn something new, and it's exciting to learn new things and exciting to learn new perspectives and sort of, I mean, it's difficult, but I find that most of the difficulty around changing my mind is that it's sort of hard to do it in public because people attack you and reject you.
You lose friends.
And you lose friends. You lose a lot of support.
That's serious, isn't it? Because you have a limited time in your life in which you can make friends. Usually after that, things turn to hard. And then if, say, in your 20s, you find that you can no longer sustain the view that you did, and most of the people you know continue to feel that way, then you'll find, like it or not, that you will lose a lot of friends and have to change your milieu. Mm-hmm. And it's also, the other thing is, it's if you've held the view very strongly, and people have heard you express it, you feel a great reluctance to publicly confess that you now no longer believe that. And I found it, when I changed my mind, I found it extremely difficult. There were long periods when I knew I ought to change my mind. I knew that I was wrong, but I wasn't prepared to concede to myself in private, let alone to anyone else in public. This is so. And I'm interested that you find it enjoyable. I found it tough. I still find it tough. It doesn't mean I don't think it's good. It's one of the best things you can possibly do. But I think that in my experience, it comes at a pretty high cost.
I mean, I don't want to say that I enjoy it so much that I do it without thought and care, but I do find it. I mean, I think that part of my process of changing my mind was that I started to feel intellectually bored with the things that I was saying. So I was sort of repeating leftist and feminist mantras that stopped having any kind of meaning for me. So I started to examine them more closely. And that's always interesting because, again, because I want to learn new things and I want to be exposed to new ideas and I want to question my own beliefs and assumptions. It's not really that fun if you're a writer or a thinker to just repeat yourself over and over and over again without thinking new thoughts about the things that you're saying, right? You want to be discovering. So I think that's part of it.
The number of people who do say the same thing over and over and over and again is quite strikingly high, it seems to me.
Right. So, I mean,
blame to them. You've been saying this for the past 20 years without any variation at all. They carry on. But no, it's true. You do need to be constantly on the move. If you're not, then you're brain dead. And the other thing is, if you are not exploring what you're saying, then your language deteriorates.
Right.
You write and you speak less coherently because you're concealing from yourself what you really think. And this is the great lesson of this of George Orwell. This is why the central part of George Orwell's work is the essay, Politics and the English Language, which everybody who does any speaking or writing should read at least twice a year, because you'll find when you read it that you have yourself been breaking the rules, which Orwell says. Everybody does. Because you haven't been being totally honest with yourself. It creeps up on you all the time, and then there's a piece of knowledge which comes your way, which explodes something you previously thought. What do you do about that? nobody but you knows, in many cases, around it. So you can just shut up about it. But in the end, by doing so, you shrivel up your internal organs. You have to admit it.
Right. So, I mean, I suppose one of the things, so you believe that the government and the politicians who are still imposing these restrictions and lockdowns, you know, extending them, you think that they know that they're doing something wrong or that they've made a mistake?
I have a suspicion that they've made a very considerable boo-boo. Yeah, I think they can see it for themselves as much as possible. I think they must. And particularly when they have meetings with their people from the Treasury, whenever we call him in Canada, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Australians call him the Treasurer, most people call him the Finance Minister, but whenever that person comes into the room and says, look, we haven't got any more of this money that you're spending, that must be a moment when they worry a bit. Because in politics, that's where the great clash of reality comes. It's when they do the sums and find they haven't got the money. That's why in almost every democratic society, the Treasury is both an important and a much disliked part of government, because politicians always hate the way the Treasury says, you can't do that. And what they also say is, what you've done here is disastrous, and it's going to take 100 years to pay off, or even longer. And this, people don't know about debt. I mean, in Britain, during my childhood and teens, we were still paying off the huge loans which the United States had given to us during and after the Second World War. And it took the edge off life. We were a pretty poor, scruffy country. We had dismal food. We wore old clothes. Our houses were badly built and poorly repaired. Our public services were a low level. I now know that the reason for that sort of scraped, pinched feeling that we all underwent, in fact, we couldn't afford to import much either, so there wasn't much in the way of consumer goods or nice food around in those days, was because we were paying off a debt. What I later discovered was an even bigger debt, which we contracted during the First World War in the United States, which we'd simply defaulted on, which is one of the great secrets of British life. But we actually stopped paying our First World War loans to the USA, and we'd never paid them back, which means is one of the reasons why we in Britain are so subservient to the United States in everything we do, and also one of the reasons why your country has moved more and more into the orbit of Washington and further away from its British connections, because we're a poor, weak country. And these things make a huge difference. And I think that's where it impinges on the, even if they don't understand anything else, they realize that something's gone seriously wrong. They spent more money than they have, and they've got no idea how to pay it back. And they will lose power as a result of it, and they will have to do terrible things as a result of it. So to that extent, at least, they must know that they're in trouble. Beyond that, I'm not sure. I don't. I have spent a lot of time talking to politicians. I don't do it anymore.
You. I feel pretty depressed about this Christmas. And I'm somebody who really likes Christmas. I'm not one of those grinchy people.
It doesn't exist for me. It's not happening. I have no Christmas at all.
And I mean, I'll see like an ad or a Christmas movie or Christmas decorations outside, and those all just make me feel depressed. The whole thing is just making me feel depressed. I just want to literally cancel the whole thing and skip it all. It's not worth it. And it makes me mad that people are still trying to pretend that Christmas is happening and that it's a fun, joyful thing when clearly this is the most depressing time.
It's a hugely important religious festival, but if I go to church, then the other people there are all masked and muzzled as if we're attending an autopsy or queuing up at an abattoir. And it doesn't feel like church to me. I feel, well, if you believe what you come here to affirm, then how can you be following the guidance of a government which is, how shall I put this, not exactly Christian, its intentional behavior. And for a long, long time in Britain, I don't know what happened in Canada, but churches were actually locked. And this is for the first time since the reign of bad King John in the early 13th century. Hmm. The churches were locked. You couldn't get into them. it's been very, very hard for religious believers this time. And I find it quite difficult to accept that the things which are taking place in churches now are really, they're really truly religious services. I can't, the whole business of Christmas, people say, well, you can't cancel Christmas. It's the great feast of the Nativity of our Lord. But of course you can't, but you can cancel every outward aspect of it so that it doesn't feel remotely like any Christmas I've ever experienced before. And I had some very odd Christmases in my life. I spent Christmas 1989 hiding under a bed in Bucharest while the train went past the window. And I spent a couple of Christmases in Moscow in the early 1990s, which are actually better than you'd think. And I very nearly got stuck in Baghdad one Christmas, but none of those has been remotely as un-Christmassy as what's going on in Britain now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, I don't think the churches were, I'm not religious. I don't go to church, but I, in Canada, what has happened, which is interesting, I've thought, is that the groups who are getting fined for not following the restrictions are church groups, because there's some churches in Canada and some pastors in Canada who have refused to follow the restrictions and are gathering regardless in protest. So essentially what they're being fined for is protesting. They're some of them are actually being fined twice. So they're being fined for protesting, and they're also being fined for, you know, operating faith-based services.
Oh, I'm sure. I have some friends in the United States in Northwest Idaho who were recently arrested for singing psalms in the United States. You really would have thought that there would be something in the Bill of Rights which meant that you could sing psalms, but no, you can be arrested for it. Even in Northwest Idaho, I have to tell you, as far as I know, at the time this demonstration, psalm singing, menacing psalm singing demonstration took place, there had been no cases of COVID-19 in that part of the United States. But nonetheless, the police moved in and they arrested people for singing psalms. It's a very peculiar age in which we live.
Ridiculous. Yeah.
Your sense of humor turned up to maximum. And the last time I turned my sense of humor up to maximum was when I was living in the Soviet Union. You had to have it up to maximum to anyway to get through the day. And now I'm doing it again.
Mm-hmm. And I saw that you
humor rushed out, of course, but if I did have, I would turn it up to nice.
Recently, I saw that you wrote on the Christmas issue, "I wish you an angry Christmas, not a merry one, because if you aren't angry this year, the chances are very strong that you won't be allowed to be married next year or the year after that."
It's what I think. And if you don't, it's fascinating thing. I'm a cyclist. I love riding bicycle. I've been riding a bicycle in London, which is a fantastically dangerous thing to do, for 40 years. And in the past few months, taking the opportunity again, never let a good crisis go to waste, of the general's shutdown and everything, quite a lot of the local authorities in London started putting huge new cycle lanes in. And even I, as a cyclist, think that cycle lanes are often a good idea, but not always, thought these were a bit excessive. And they got in the way, they blocked traffic, and they generally messed up people's lives and slowed down the city. And quite a lot of people got very forcefully angry about it. Some of them just normal people, some of them celebrities, and they campaigned against it. Would you believe most of these things have gone? They were put up in sort of April, May, June, and they've gone now because people get angry about them. Well, I say, well, okay, I don't blame you for getting angry about these cycle lanes, but why do you get angry about the fact that your personal freedom has been taken away? Why do you get angry about the fact that you can't work? Why are you angry about the fact that you won't have a job in 6 months' time, or your business that you spent 20 years building up and mortgaging your house on is being destroyed? Are you angry about that? Because if you don't, then the government will carry on trampling on all these things. But people will only get angry at really small, particular things. It's like this great passage in 1984, where Orwell says people are like the ant, which can only see small things and not big things. Mm-hmm. And they don't protest against the big things. They only get exercised about the small things. It's in that wonderful passage where Winston Smith goes into a proletarian pub. And there's an old man who's trying to buy a pint of beer, and the barman won't serve him a pint because they only have liters. They went metric long before and it's a wonderful scene. But at some point, he's trying to get the old man to tell him what the past was like, and the old man can't remember anything interesting or useful at all because of this complete human inability to see or remember big things or understand them.
And here right. Yeah, I mean, it has been interesting to observe, well, interesting, that's probably the wrong descriptor, to observe the misdirected anger and how much people prefer to be angry about, you know, angry at their neighbors, angry at somebody mm-hmm. who's not wearing a mask, angry at somebody who's, you know, gathering with their family or with a friend and have refused to be angry about the immense impacts on all of our lives and society and the economy. And, you know, it's depressed. I'm angry every day about this, and it's incredibly depressing.
I fight it down because what good does it do unless I direct it somewhere? But there's people have to learn to be angry about the right thing.
So finally, what do you think we should do?
It's very limited. I mean, I don't know. In Canada, you may have more recourse to the courts. In Britain, we've had a very determined attempt by a multi-millionaire called Simon Dolan, backed by a lot of public contributions, to take the government to court over what he, I think, rightly thought was an abuse of power. The parliamentary laws that should have been used to do this almost certainly been exceeded, and they shouldn't have been used. And very, very serious and thoughtful lawyers agree with this. But the courts in Britain wouldn't hear it. They wouldn't hear the case. I mean, he spent an awful lot of time just trying to get them to hear what is called a judicial review. And a couple of weeks ago, he was finally told by the Supreme Court of England that he could not take his case. So our judges simply say the government can pretty much do what it likes. So that's not a recourse that we can have. So what is the law-abiding person? And I am a law-abiding person, I believe, with passion, actually, and a word I seldom use, in the importance of the rule of law. What does the law-abiding person who wishes to maintain social peace do about this? And all we can do is to try and persuade our members of parliament that they're not taking this seriously. And I say to people, they say, well, I've written to my member of parliament, he hasn't answered. I've written to my member of parliament, and she sent me this stupid cut-and-paste reply. I said, well, of course, don't try and argue with these bluebies. Most of them don't know anything and they can't think. But if they get enough letters from enough people saying, you're not doing your job, you're not representing me, and if you vote repeatedly to destroy the livelihoods of others, don't expect to be employed yourself after the next election. If there's enough of that, and it has to be numbers, get your neighbours, get your colleagues, get your family, get your friends, recruit them to do this again and again and again. Acid, polite, brief, over and over again, as many as possible, you might just conceivably make them think that if they don't do something, and they are the only source in our free society of alternative power, that they might do something, then we could get this overturned. We have, in fact, created in Britain over the past 6 months an opposition of up to 60 MPs, as more or less one in 10, who've begun to question the government, whereas in the beginning they were... I mean, the word supine would have been a compliment to them. They are now actually standing up a bit. So it does make a difference, but you really have to keep it. I can think of nothing else because any other form of civil disobedience and all the rest, once you go down that path, you license other people to go down that path as well, and it's terrifying, and I don't want to do it. But I think there is a possibility, but you really have to keep at it. And you really have to get as many people as possible to do it. I can offer nothing else, but I do offer it, and I think that if it were pursued by enough people, it would be effective.
That's all from me. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. I know you're so busy, and so thank you for taking the time to.
Well, for my part, it's been a great pleasure, and I'm grateful to you for having me on.
I hope that you have a tolerable Christmas.
Well, it's all we can really hope for, isn't it? Yeah. If I weren't what I am, I'd do what so many people did in the old Soviet bloc, which is go into what's called internal exile, where you just live more or less independently from the state and everything that it says. I can't do that because I have a public position to maintain, and it's not possible. Mm-hmm. But there remain constellations in private life, as thank heaven there have to be. But good heavens, they're very heavily drawn upon at times like these. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, and maybe we can actually meet someday.
I would love to.
Resume the conversation in more civilized settings.
Indeed. Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode and are enjoying the other interviews and the content we're producing, please do consider becoming a patron. Just head over to patreon.com/Megan Murphy and sign up. 5, 10, 25 bucks a month. It all helps. We rely entirely on supporters and donors like you to keep doing this work. Thank you so much. We'll catch you next time on The Same Drugs with Megan Murphy.